Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with what appears to be dark days, if not years, descending on Egypt, where the military government is issuing mass death sentences on hundreds of supporters of the ousted Muslim Brotherhood government for the death of one policeman. Khaled El-Gindi, a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, joins us to discuss the dashed hopes for democracy in Egypt, where the popular backlash against the incompetent Morsi government has given the military and their Saudi backers a blank check and an opportunity to turn back the clock. Then we'll examine the arguments before the Supreme Court in a case which could allow business owners to refuse to comply with the Affordable Care Act's provisions to cover the birth control needs of female employees. Jody Jacobson, the president and editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, joins us to discuss whether or not the Supreme Court will open a Pandora's box that would sanction bigotry and anti-science ignorance, allowing businesses to refuse service to LGBT customers on religious grounds and parents to refuse to immunize their kids based on biblical interpretations. Then finally, we will speak with the veteran reporter and best-selling author William Grider, whose latest book is Come Home America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. He joins us to discuss his article at The Nation, Spy Agencies, Not Politicians, Hold the Cards in Washington, and the extent to which the Washington portrayed in the TV hit series House of Cards exaggerates the power and mendacity of politicians when it is, as Grider suggests, the spooks and the spies who shuffle the deck and deal the cards. And joining us now is Khaled El-Gindi, who's a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. Welcome to Background Briefing, Khaled El-Gindi.
Thanks for having me.
And the New York Times is just carrying an editorial about Egypt that's as though sort of dark days are descending on Egypt, an alarming downward spiral, they refer to. The idea that 529 people have been charged with the murder of killing one police officer somewhat strikes me about it's almost reminiscent of World War II in occupied France, where if the French resistance killed a German soldier, the Germans retaliated by killing 500 French villagers. You think that's a fair analogy in terms of overkill?
Well, it's certainly overkill. I suppose I don't know enough about World War II history to say whether, you know, it's an exact analogy, but there's no question that this is, you know, an egregious violation of due process. I mean, it was a sham of a process, I think, in every way, and it was clearly, I think that was clear to anyone who looked at it objectively. I think the New York Times editorial is exactly right, that Egypt, it is a sign, I think, of this continuing downward spiral that we've seen not just over the last 3 years, but specifically since July. We've seen a number of mass arrests and mass killings and mob violence, attacks on journalists, both by the state and by sort of street mobs. And it's extremely, extremely disturbing, I think, and you know, it's hard to imagine what sort of state of mind, you know, Egyptian authorities have to be in to think that these sorts of measures will in any way lead to stability. I think quite the opposite.
Well, the New York Times editorial concludes saying that inexplicably the United States and Britain issued separate, similarly weak statements which said that they were deeply concerned about the death sentences. That's unlikely to have much of effect on Egypt's military and a population that largely seems willing to tolerate its abuses. What's your sense? You're there in Washington. Why is the White House and the State Department so tepid?
Well, I think when it comes to Egypt, there's a great deal of confusion in the administration, and frankly, even beyond Washington, there's a lot of confusion as to what exactly is happening in Egypt, why authorities are taking the measures that they are, and there's a real loss, I think, for you know, alternatives. I think the administration has simply decided Egypt is going to do what it's going to do, and it's best if they sort of stay out of it and try to incur minimal damage along the way. I think that's the basic calculation. I think the what sort of is behind that is this sense of powerlessness, that anything the United States says or does is likely to backfire or simply fall on deaf ears or not work. So the calculation that they seem to have made is, well, let's just, you know, do the absolute minimum that we need to do. And I think that's a mistake. I think, you know, it's something much stronger than the kinds of words and statements that we've seen needs to be done. But at the same time, the U.S. is walking a very delicate line, because Egypt is not just about Egypt. It's also about Egypt's neighborhood. Obviously, there's the situation in Syria, which complicates the entire regional situation. There's the ongoing issue with Iran. And when it comes to Egypt in particular, the two closest U.S. allies in the region, Israel and Saudi Arabia, are very happy with how this Egyptian regime is behaving. So I think, you know, the calculation the administration is making is not just in relation to Egypt and not wanting to annoy that government, but also with an eye on its other allies in the region.
Again, I'm speaking with Khaled El-Gindi, who's a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. So President Obama goes to Saudi Arabia on Friday. And there's no question that the Saudis support this military government, that they're against the uprising against Mubarak. There are reports at the time of Tahrir Square that every day the Saudi king was on the phone yelling at Obama, saying, you've got to let Mubarak shoot those kids and stop this. And it's pretty clear that the Saudi Arabians do not want this kind of model of governance to compete with their model of governance, because they're sitting on a powder keg at home, I imagine, being, you know, essentially a feudal state with no parliament, no democracy, nothing that resembles anything that we would consider a democracy. Essentially you're entirely dependent upon the largesse of the royal family.
I think that's basically correct. I think you know, the Saudis were clearly unhappy with Mubarak's departure and the American position in allowing that, or acquiescing in it, at least. And they were even more upset with the election of a Muslim Brotherhood member to the presidency. I think what the Saudis saw, the danger of, obviously, any sort of transition to genuine democracy poses a threat to a regime like the Saudi monarchy. And it's something that they would not want to see spread. And having this happen in the largest, most populous, and arguably most important Arab state was a clear danger. Now, add on top of that, the first elected president is a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, and all of the red flags are up as far as the Saudis are concerned. And they saw an opportunity, I think, last year, in the middle of last year, when there was widespread discontent with Morsi's rule, the same opportunity that I think the Egyptian military saw, which was to, in a way, turn back the clock. And if we can just make this all go away, they and the region will be much better off.
But that's the feeling that I get, is that there's an unreal quality to this, Khalid El-Gindi, that the idea that you can turn the clock back, that you can go back to a military government funded in part by the Saudi monarchy, who spent something like, they in the Gulf have spent something like $32 billion. I don't know whether at the end of the day there's ever going to be anything to show for it. How could you have a viable government that oppresses or outlaws about, what, 40% of its own population?
Yeah, I mean, I think the percentages are not clear. I'm not sure that the Brotherhood represents 40% of the population, but clearly they are. They were and are the largest organized opposition force, even after the crackdown and the crushing by the military and the police. I think they are still a potent political force that command the sympathies of a significant number of Egyptians. It's also true that a very significant number of Egyptians have turned against the Brotherhood, or were always against the Brotherhood. You know, the Brotherhood's relative popularity aside, or unpopularity, it's clear that you cannot simply wish away or legislate away or ban a political opposition group that is as old and deeply entrenched as the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think it is bound to fail. The problem is that clearly the Saudis and the Egyptian regime don't see things that way. They think you can turn back the clock, and they think that they have turned back the clock. You know, you just said a moment ago that you can't go back to a military government. Well, we've gone back to a military government in Egypt, and we've gone back to a repressive regime, and it's one that actually has fairly broad popular support. So for the time being, it looks like it's quite doable because it's being done. I'm not sure that it's sustainable over the long term or indefinitely, because it is it's such a destabilizing force. I think they've essentially miscalculated on two fronts. The first is to assume that somehow you can rely on the state institutions like the judiciary, like the police and the interior ministry that were extremely corrupt, and one of the many reasons why you had an uprising in 2011 to begin with, that somehow you can rely on these failed and corrupt institutions today when they weren't really working properly 3 or 4 years ago. I think that's the first miscalculation. The other miscalculation is to assume that the public will acquiesce in this kind of repression indefinitely. I think as it becomes clearer over time that this regime is incapable, actually, of addressing Egypt's serious social and economic problems, then I think we might see a different type of dynamic as far as public opinion is concerned. But right now, you know, the average Egyptian is not terribly concerned about rights or about democracy or about due process. They're concerned about power outages, the economy, unemployment, sort of day-to-day governance and services that are not being met. And, you know, for now, they're willing to sort of give the regime a very long leash. But I'm not sure how long that will last.
Well, Khalid El-Gindi, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Sure, you're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Khalid El-Gindi, who's a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about arguments before the Supreme Court that could open a Pandora's box sanctioning bigotry and anti-science ignorance.
الغضب قلوب ملية شجر الحكاية مواويل طرب بواقي الحب سواقي غضب قلوب ملية شجر الحكاية Jesus coming, Jesus comes to pave the way. Do you believe in his sweet sensation? Do you believe in a second chance? Do you believe in rapture, boy?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jody Jacobson, who's President and Editor-in-Chief of RH Reality Check, and a longtime leader in the health and development community, and an advocate with extensive experience in public health, gender equity, human rights, environment, and demographic issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jody Jacobson.
Thank you for having me.
And the Supreme Court heard arguments today from they're taking up this case, one of the plaintiffs, I guess, is Hobby Lobby, which is a chain of craft stores owned by a Christian family, and the other is the Conestoga Wood Specialties, which makes wood cabinets, and that's owned by a Mennonite family. And this, I take it, it could be a real Pandora's box if the Supreme Court rules in favor of Hobby Lobby, because couldn't it open up questions about religious exemptions for example, immunizing your kids and stuff like that? Will it stop?
I think it's really important to understand that the implications of the case, as you note, go well beyond contraception. I mean, it's bad enough that they're seeking to exempt themselves from a major form of primary reproductive health care for women, and that has a lot of roots in what's going on around reproductive health care more generally in the United States. But yes, it absolutely can have much broader implications. If you remember recently, for example, there was a law that was vetoed by Governor Jan Brewer in Arizona, which sought to allow businesses to decide to deny services to gay, lesbian, and transgender people if they had a religious objection to gay, lesbian, and transgender people. So this kind of thing, this kind of behavior, this kind of discrimination, whether it be in a healthcare, vaccination, you know, eliminating child care benefits because they think women should stay at home, or discriminating against gay people, or not providing providing health care to AIDS patients because, you know, they believe in that an AIDS patient was infected by HIV through sex, and they don't believe in sex. I mean, all of these things now become open for question.
Well, there is a law, is there not? The Religious Freedom Restoration Act that was signed by Bill Clinton.
Yes.
And how does that impact on the parameters of this case, do you think, Jody?
What's happened is that ever since that law was signed into law, the religious right has been using every ounce of energy they have, and they're being helped by corporate donors to expand exemptions to everything, for conscience clauses. Most recently, for example, in Virginia, where the Governor McAuliffe signed into law a law that allows genetic counselors to deny giving proper information on genetic counseling if they feel like the outcome is not one consistent with their religious belief. So there's so many different ways in which these things are creeping into law, in which the far right is using the basis of RFRA to expand upon it and to turn it into something that, in effect, turns the United States into a Christian nation as they see it.
So do we have any polling on the justices, the extent to which they are, any of them, a part of this idea of a Christian nation, which is, you know, there's quite a lot of literature on it. And there's, I mean, I know, for example, Ted Cruz's father is a part of that movement. But does it? Do you think any of that stuff resonates with the justices on the court?
Well, unfortunately, I think it does resonate with some of them, including Scalia and Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, certainly, and then to a certain extent with others. So, you know, I fear that the court is, that for one thing, this is a court that is very isolated, you know, largely, not only, but, you know, the majority of the single largest group is mainstream white males who are have shown a lack of understanding, particularly about the struggles that women face and about their reproductive health. So I have no real confidence in those people about making a sound decision based both on science and equity. I'm afraid that what they are going to do is make an equivalency out of the arguments put forth by the far right, as well as those put forth by the corporations in Citizens United. So they will, I'm afraid there's a good chance that they will err on the side of the so-called religious liberty argument.
Again, I'm speaking with Jody Jacobson, who's president and editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check. She's a longtime leader in the health and development community and an advocate with extensive experience in public health, gender equity, human rights, environment, and demographic issues. And in terms of the Supreme Court hearing this case, where they're weighing whether business owners can object to part of President Obama's health care law, which, of course, they've upheld, the contraception mandate itself does include exemptions for churches, and it makes accommodations for religiously affiliated nonprofits such as schools and hospitals. But for-profit corporations like Hobby Lobby, etc., are required to cover the full range of women's preventative care, including birth control and IUDs and emergency contraception, and at no cost to their female employees. Now, you would think that in the business world, it's like, almost like the press. You know, one of the reasons why we have in our press in this country, you have the opinion of one side and then the equal and opposite opinion of the other. In many ways, that has its roots in a recognition on the part of media companies that half of your customers or half of your readers or viewers are Republicans and half of them are Democrats. So in order not to offend either Democrats or Republicans, you always have, in quotes, balance, you know, not fair and balanced like Fox, but you know what I'm talking about. So why doesn't that restrain Hobby Lobby? I mean, why are they the outlier here?
Why doesn't the press's giving both sides?
Why doesn't the corporation, understanding that, you know, if you're going to start proselytizing with your product, you're going to lose a lot of customers. And that seems to be a sort of natural restraint on business, not to get involved in politics, you know. So,
I think that, in fact, that might be the sort of conventional wisdom about conventional corporations.
Right.
But we're talking about the religious right, and they have their own worldview. They have their own customer base. They also have, as we've shown in reporting this week, a substantial amount of money coming to them from corporate donors and dark money sources like the Koch brothers. We published an investigative piece that looked at, for example, who are the funds behind many of these contraceptive mandate cases, and they are folks from far-right corporate leadership. So, you know, I think that it's a very different calculus when you have an agenda to really and truly transcend what democracy is and create a sort of, you know, religious state, which is their end goal. Then you're not really worried about in the short term whether you're going to piss off some customers.
So is it then possible that the Koch brothers, who I don't know, are famous for their religiosity as for their, to put it bluntly, greed, are they getting in on the act and funding these cases just to destroy the Affordable Care Act, which they clearly are opposed to?
Yes, they've come together to destroy the Affordable Care Act overall, but, you know, they're also very much linked into a whole host of other efforts together, such as cutting Social Security, blocking efforts to raise the minimum wage. There are so many different areas in which these groups are interlocked, and they really have what I would call as an anti-life agenda, if you put them together as what they should be, which is, you know, they're sort of different branches of the same family tree.
So what's the sense then, Jody Jacobson, of how the Solicitor General handled his arguments? I mean, obviously you can never figure out from these hearings exactly which way the court's going to go, but what impression did you get in terms of the way the government, you know, the case is Sebelius versus Hobby Lobby. So how did Varelli do?
Well, to be honest with you, I just had started reading the transcripts, which I've just gotten hold of, and I wasn't in the courtroom or in the media center at the Supreme Court, so I didn't hear all the ins and outs. One thing I am concerned about is that I did get the sense that the Solicitor General, and I fear much of the administration, doesn't really have its own very strong grasp on both the economic issues behind access to birth control as well as the health components of birth control, in the sense that, you know, they tend also to play on the field of, is it an abortifacient or isn't it? You know, rather than making clear that here's what the science says, this is not abortifacient, and here we're talking about denying women, primary preventive care. And I still feel like they don't really get the arguments where they need to be.
Well, you'd think, though, with what just took place in Arizona that you mentioned earlier, Jody Jacobson, the Arizona's so-called religious freedom bill, which the governor finally vetoed, even though she was a part of generating the bill, and she did that because business interests were pushed back. Surely that's got to be in the consciousness of people. I mean, if the Supreme Court rules in favor of Hobby Lobby, then laws like that will they are already on proliferating around the country at any rate. Arizona's not the only one that has this anti-gay bill, as far as I know. Wouldn't that just be an open season?
But I think that what's critical here is that the Supreme Court rule the right way so that these other laws can be stood up against a major decision by the court that, in fact, you know, religious liberty cannot be had by imposing the so-called religious beliefs of a corporation on its employees, which then redounds to other kinds of cases that we will see, you know, like the one you talked about, you know, discrimination against gay persons and so forth, that those things will have a precedent as against which to be measured and a precedent that does not allow them, as opposed to allowing this and that becoming precedent, which I think will open the floodgates. I really think we'll see no end at all.
Well, was there a sense, though, that argument was made? I mean, I'm reading the transcripts, too. I don't get the impression that...
I don't. Yeah. I don't get the impression, but like I say, I haven't gone through all of them yet.
Right. Well, but this is huge, isn't it? I mean, this is... I take it you're alarmed by it. I'm alarmed by it. I mean, most of our listeners should be, that this could be a huge Pandora's box.
Yes, absolutely. I totally agree with you.
Well, what are you going to do going forward now? I guess what can you do? It's in the hands of these justices, right?
Well, you know, we're a media organization, so we can't necessarily do anything except do what we continue to do, which is unearth who's behind these things, continue to put forth the evidence, continue to ensure that all the people involved are clearly educated about the issues. You know, I think that the justices have their own biases, and those need to be laid bare. We saw, for example, that Justice Scalia, in another case, called sidewalk protesters outside abortion clinics sidewalk counselors. Now, we have more than ample evidence that these folks are not counselors. In fact, the violence that they exhibit in much of their activity would belie the fact that they are not counselors. But you have a really, really strong, either a very strongly biased person or a person who is extraordinarily cocooned in another world or both. And my concern is that, again, that these justices are not necessarily, looking with an understanding, empathetic perspective of what these decisions really mean for people, and rather they are thinking about it from their own narrow perspectives. That's my concern.
Well, it's certainly a reason to be concerned when Justice Scalia starts talking about, obviously, the morning after pill that he clearly objects to. And look at the trial that went through. How that so much effort was made by the registrar to stop that, which I understand is perfectly safe, and they've done everything in the world to try and restrict that. And having Justice Scalia bring it up is a little alarming, to say the least.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Jody, and thank you for your work.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Ian.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I've been just speaking then with Jody Jacobson, who's the President and Editor-in-Chief of RH Reality Check and a longtime leader in the health and development community and an advocate with extensive experience in public health, gender equity, human rights, environment, and demographic issues. We can take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how in Washington it's the spooks and spies who shuffle the deck and deal the cards. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Grider, who's a national affairs correspondent for The Nation and the author of the national bestsellers One World, Ready or Not, Who Will Tell the People, and The Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. A reporter for 40 years, he has written for The Washington Post, Rolling Stone, and has been an on-air correspondent for 6 frontline documentaries on PBS. His latest book is Come Home, America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. And his latest article at The Nation is Spy Agencies, Not Politicians, Hold the Cards in Washington. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Grider.
Thank you, Ian.
And this battle that's going on between the United States Senate and the CIA, I guess, surprised some people in as much as the head of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, Dianne Feinstein, who's been considered to be fairly compliant, seemed to have shown some backbone and some resolve. What do you think it was the motivating factor there? Is this a turf battle? Is this about...
I think it's profound. I made slight fun of these powerhouse people, both in the Congress and the White House and the CIA and the National Security Agency. They're all suddenly at each other's throats, and I think we can credit, I think that's good, by the way, because these agencies have gone way off their reasonable limits and lied both to the Congress and the public, and the indictment is pretty clear. But I think you can credit, among others, but especially man I call Citizen Snowden, who, as we know, was the techie who, working for a contractor, saw the scope of what the NSA was spying on and what they were doing with this information, and was properly appalled, and as a citizen took the risk of leaking these documents. And I think he's now, getting beat up by the right wingers and even some of the left wingers who think that our security as a nation depends upon these secret agencies, which I think is bunk. But I think in time Americans will understand that this young man did a great favor for the Republic. And he at least has started the possibility that the country will turn on these agencies because they're damaging not just to the foreign people who get spied upon, but the Americans who get spied upon. And that's way over the line of what we thought was our constitutional government.
But what seems to be happening here with this 6,300-page report on the Bush-Cheney torture regime, that's what's being contested, and that's what's being held up by the CIA.
Right.
It's cost the taxpayer $40 million to do this apparently exhaustive review of what happened. And frankly, I don't know why anybody on this planet would be defending Bush and Cheney. I mean, look what's happening now,
yeah.
Bill Greider, with Russia and Ukraine. The U.S. doesn't have a leg to stand on in terms of moral posturing over invading other countries.
No, absolutely. And I think if we rolled back the camera for 10 years, these same people who are now indignant because the CIA, the NSA, CIA evidently spied on them, that is, looked over their shoulder through these computer systems and saw that this Senate committee was getting to some ground they didn't want it to go to. And that's what Senator Feinstein was enraged about, that, oh, my gosh, the spies are spying on us. There was a wonderful headline in the Huffington Post that captured the absurdity of this situation. It said something like, Senators okay with spying on citizens, but not spying on them. And that's pretty much the situation. And I think it's indicative of the lax oversight of the Congress, not to mention the White House, that here we are 10 years later, and they're running this massive investigation of how did this torture happen. And I suspect they're also re-arguing the question of, well, is the torture really torture? Which is itself, all this is an absurdity. They should have blown the whistle in 2002, 2003, when we first learned about this stuff?
Well, we only first learned about it because of Colonel Wilkerson, Colin Powell's chief of staff, breaking ranks ending his career.
That's right. And there were a couple of reporters. I remember Cy Hirsch and I think Dana Priest at the Washington Post, who wrote the first. She, I think, wrote the first stories about these underground transport of so-called terrorist suspects, where the U.S. the CIA was literally shipping them to countries where the government didn't give a crap about torture. They were for it themselves, and so there they could torture these people. Beyond the purview of U.S. law, they said. Well, that's nonsense. It's a U.S. agency. They're responsible for their behavior wherever it happens. But here we are, 10, 12 years later, suddenly arguing over that again. And meanwhile, Ian, I think you've had this experience with me before. Once you get me started, I just keep going because I am, as you can tell, animated by this subject. I think. And that's why I wrote that piece sort of mocking these people, because they deserve to be mocked and denounced. I compared in my piece, House of Cards, which people in your city know, I'm sure, is a wonderful American version, and I love the British version, which preceded it. But I said it's the wrong story. The story is not scheming politicians murdering each other and scrambling to the top of the slippery pole. It's these two spy agencies, which in a way have a handle on the politicians and are dancing them around like puppets.
Again, I'm speaking with William Greider, who's the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation and the author of national bestsellers One World, Ready or Not, Who Will Tell the People, and Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. A reporter for 40 years, he has written for The Washington Post and Rolling Stone and has been an on-air correspondent for 6 Frontline documentaries on PBS. His latest book is Come Home, America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. And his latest article at The Nation is Spy Agencies, Not Politicians, Hold the Cards in Washington. Now, one of the things that I find disturbing about this whole civil liberties spying issues that Snowden most certainly provoked the debate on is the extent to which the left is being eclipsed by people on the right or the libertarian right like Ron Paul, who was recently out here in California at Berkeley winning over students. And a lot of young college kids are drinking the libertarian Kool-Aid. They think it's just because they're in favor of smoking pot and against foreign wars. They forget the fact that the libertarians want the Koch brothers to run America and get rid of the government altogether. But I noticed that that Rand Paul was making digs at Obama about this issue and basically saying, well, it's pretty strange to have a black man in the White House who's bringing back the days of J. Edgar Hoover spying on Martin Luther King. Pretty strong barb, wouldn't you say?
That was a little over the line, I would say, to bring race into this subject, because although his point has a factual grounding, it does. I think it's a cheap shot, because why should black Americans be especially sensitive to this question than white Americans? I mean, we should all be sensitive to it. So it's a cheap distinction. Nevertheless, your larger point is right, and it upsets me. Although, frankly, I've given up on the Democratic Party a while ago, because they don't have the nerve, with a couple of exceptions, to stand up and tell the truth about this situation. And I don't give Dianne Feinstein any credit. She's fronted for these people for, what, 20 years as a chairman or vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee? And whatever is revealed, she usually has an explanation of how it's misunderstood or blah, blah, blah. So, but the Democratic Party in general, I find, and I'm including the president, but not the president alone, they're so confused now about their political standing that they're pretty nervous about every subject. And they have a couple of swords they wave in the air on stuff that, of course, I think is correct, raising the minimum wage and some stuff like that and the immigration problems. But there isn't. It's like the party is brain dead. And this one, you're absolutely right. The libertarians have always been righteous on the subject of privacy and free speech and all that constitutional ground. So it's not new for them. I mean, you can't accuse Rand Paul of, you know, stealing the other guy's issue. It's been his issue forever and his father's before him. But nevertheless, in olden days, when I was a young reporter in Washington, there would have been a dozen Democrats on the floor of the Senate standing up in vigorous protest in the presence of a Democratic president that was not inhibiting. So now I think they would say, oh, well, we're in a bad shape for this election this year. We don't want to make it worse for our party and our candidates and so forth. Well, to me, the silence, their silence is making it worse. It's giving people fresh reasons to be indifferent about the outcome of the election. I read the newspapers. I have no idea whether those dire predictions about what's going to happen to Democrats in the Senate are correct or not. I will find out soon enough.
Well, they appear to be blaming the messenger, Nate Silver, at the moment.
Oh, really? I missed that.
Yeah, well, he came up with this prediction.
I heard his numbers, yeah.
Yeah, and that's freaked them out, and now they're sort of complaining about his methodology, or et cetera, which nobody's ever complained about before since he's been consistently right.
No, not when it was
going the
other way.
Yeah. Well, but that's, I think the point that you're making there, Bill Greider, is the point. You know, if these gutless people who are incapable of taking a stand, except, say, for Senators Merkley and Udall on the Intelligence Committee who pushed this issue, then if you don't stand for something, then why not vote for the other guy?
Yeah.
You know,
I mean,
we know what the other guy stands for. It's not very good, but
yeah,
at least it's something, you know.
Well, and I think the Republicans, for reasons we're familiar with, are in their own kind of breakdown I mean, they've sort of lost it, right? And they're swinging back and forth on some of the nut stuff and then some other stuff that's not nutty, but nevertheless dramatically off the usual Republican path. And I would not be surprised if in the coming years the Democratic Party winds up in a similar condition. It'll be around different issues, of course, but they have gotten used to not speaking to a lot of stuff. And the president reflects that, but so do the members, at least the bulk of the members in the Congress, especially in the U.S. Senate. House Democrats are a bit better, but they get a free ride because they're in a minority and they can't assert themselves much anyway. But we're going to go through a couple of elections and find out whether this sort of limp-wristed political party is a permanent fixture or whether it's just a few bad years when they lost their way. I'm not optimistic, frankly.
So it's the gutless party versus the crazy party.
Yeah, something like that.
And what a choice.
And the crazy party, like all sort of, the truth, the crazy idiots standing in the middle of the road, some of what they say is actually true. so you tend to credit them for those moments of clarity.
Right. It's like the broken clock is right twice a day, right?
The other party is just sort of hunkered down in the corner hoping they won't be noticed.
Right.
And it's a pretty dismal choice. And that's why I'm celebrating. And I'm if you read the piece, my tone was kind of,
yeah,
this is good news. These people are at each other's throats. That's very promising.
Well, what do you think, though, will be the outcome? Will we ever see this 6,300-page report on the torture regime from the Bush days?
Well, I hope we will. I mean, but I don't think that's not the crucial element. This is quite totally a coincidence. I wish I could take credit for it, but in the New York Times has a story today, which is from those anonymous sources we all know so well from the White House, explaining that the president is going to do this and this and this to limit the scope of the NSA, and he doesn't quite have it ready yet, but he's going to produce it rather soon, and so forth and so on.
Right. This is the headline that Obama to call for end of, to NSA's bulk collection. Bulk data collection, right?
Yeah, well, but you read the story, it's sufficiently vague and wobbly in its phrasing. It's not clear when you finish the story what, if anything, they're going to do, except they're going to change the rules a little bit. And they haven't done that, so don't hold your breath. But I think it's so obvious. Here's a deeper meaning of these events, Ian. And I said this in the piece. We had these, I'm being, again, playful, but I said these computer geeks come along, and they're offended by things they know or they've seen, and they literally, I'm talking about Wikipedia, WikiLeaks and Snowden, have blown the doors off secrecy. They really have, and that's obvious to people around the world, and people around the world are reacting to that. And in this country, the political system doesn't know how to react to it, except with a few brave exceptions. So it's just sitting there unacknowledged on the table, but it changes everything whether they want it changed or not. So it would be reasonable to assume that this isn't over, that Citizen Snowden and like-minded people have a whole closet full of stuff that they can put on the table. And the government is acting like, well, we're going to get these guys somehow, and when we get a hold of them, we're going to put them in prison for the rest of their lives or blah, blah, blah. Here's what ran in the paper last week, I think it was, in the Washington Post, ran a story supplied to them by Snowden that said the CIA, the NSA now has the capability to record 100% of the telephone conversations in a foreign country. And it is doing that in one foreign, at least one foreign country right now. And it has programmed or envisioned in its papers, reports, all secret, of course, that it will do this in five more countries. So as I suggested in the piece, the Washington Post reported in the story, we're not going to tell you the names of those countries because the White House asked us not to, and they thought it would be, complicate their lives, as indeed it would, if you name the countries. But Mr. Snowden knows the names of those countries.
I think he's probably in one of them, isn't he?
He may well be in one of them.
Right.
And I suggested he hold a worldwide contest. Are you the country that's if you talk on the telephone in Moldova or Ukraine or China or Russia, you're going in the files. And we've got tape, voice recordings of what you said. And it doesn't matter if you're in government or out of government. If you're using a telephone, we've got you, or a cell phone. I mean, isn't that it's by standalone by itself a stunning fact? And wouldn't it be easy enough for the government to say, well, we disapprove of that, and we are today, by executive order, telling the SAA to unplug that program now. Not. We're not going to study it for a couple of years. We're going to do it right now because it's wrong to do to a foreign country. And I can tell you, the foreign countries, when they find out which ones they are, they will react accordingly. And should. Wouldn't we? Anyway, I think a far-sighted government would recognize its dilemma and sort of get ahead of the story by saying, we're going to deal with this now. Instead, I predict we will wait and wait and wait, and then one way or another, those names will pop out, and the problem will get bigger for President Obama and for the Congress and for Senator Feinstein and all the rest. So maybe that's what it takes to unwind this incredible system that the government has created. But I'm not a hobby horse on civil liberties and so forth. I believe in the same things most people believe in. But this strikes me as, I'm in Washington, D.C., as you know, and I don't get a feeling from the press or from the political dialogue that the folks in this town yet understands the depths of what this exposure has done to the federal government and to both parties.
Well, it looks as though people in the business community, particularly in the new high-tech industries, the Silicon Valley industries, they've been getting it for a long time, and it's affecting their bottom line. I mean,
that's
they went
right
along with the government. They were in collusion with the government, Google and these big, and Facebook and others, and Verizon, et cetera, until it started to hurt their business bottom line. And they're losing customers all around the world because foreign customers don't want to be involved with U.S. internet companies, and because they think that there's a built-in trapdoor to the NSA. And they've been lobbying the White House. And I think didn't they show up at the White House just a week or so ago?
Yeah, a bunch of them went in last week and delivered that message to the president in private, but it was reported. And I think that's part of what I mean when I say they don't realize the depth of the damage, because that will happen. And we're now in a situation where if you're in Germany or China or France or any number of other countries that are direct rivals to the U.S. in global trade and production, you got to ask yourself, should we just pretend this didn't happen, or should we develop our own systems? And I'm not good on this. You probably know more about it than I do, but I know there were the beginnings, I think, in Germany, among other places, of developing essentially rival internets that would be different systems and could operate in the world alongside the U.S.-dominated internet. And but for their own privacy purposes, create these systems. Now, I haven't seen this discussed lightly in the newspapers, but my hunch is that there are people somewhere on the West Coast talking about this, and there are people in Europe and Asia saying, wait a minute, we don't need to go to the U.S. system where we guaranteed to be spied on by the U.S. government. We can't, first of all, we can't do it, but we have the ability to break that up. And so what you could see in the long run is the disintegration of this wonderful world utility, which mostly the U.S. created, and now it's been abused, and it's tainted. And I don't know the technology well enough to know. Can you undo that stain once it's there? I don't know.
Well, they're already there. You know, Russia and China and other countries are already within the umbrella group that controls the internet, which is certainly situated here in the United States. Began here, and we've created the rules of the road.
Right.
Now they're starting to question the rules of the road. And, of course, China and Russia are not doing it for the best reasons. They're doing it because they want more censorship and more control,
right,
and deny their citizens information. But this is blowback. I mean, this is just blowback from the abuse of something. And we only have ourselves to blame.
Well, there was a little story in the papers last week, I think, and I can't even remember the name of the group. It's basically the technical group that supervises the internet and does the name recordings, and you know what I'm talking about. And the U.S. Commerce Department announced out of the blue that they were ceding their role as the director general of this thing and allowing this international group to operate. I guess we'll still be a member, but we were the guy in charge, and we volunteered to surrender that position to the international group. And I bet you anything, that's exactly the conversation they had worldwide, and just told the U.S., look, this is untenable. If you don't change your position, we're getting out, or we're going to just shut down this international group. So this is just the beginning of, I think, it's going to be a huge story, and it will really test the integrity of the U.S. society, really, not just the government, as do you really intend to work toward a globally compatible system, or are you just out doing capitalism's thing for your own benefit, and never mind who gets screwed?
Well, that's, William Grider, I appreciate your time today, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with William Grider, who's a national affairs correspondent for The Nation and the author of the national bestsellers One World, Ready or Not, Who Will Tell the People, Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. A reporter for 40 years, he has written for The Washington Post and Rolling Stone and has been an on-air correspondent for 6 Frontline documentaries on PBS. And his latest book is Come Home, America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. And his latest article at The Nation is Spy Agencies, Not Politicians, Hold the Cards in Washington. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.